Chapter 21. The Perfect Lay. I was exploring the town when I quickly realized I'd thought us into a corner with my brilliantly wonderful idiot fucking mind. I'd given much thought to what we might do to make some money during our travel, owing to the fact that lout of a giant simply refused to fight. I guess we could have sought some honest work as laborers, maybe dock workers in a small river town. Probably it wouldn't have been so hard to find something. It seemed Dittmar's recruiters took more men south every day. But honest work didn't pay so well, I had found, and after our little foray into the crier's life, I'd caught the sickness that is only cured by fast money. That full purse buried at the bottom of our cart made me greedy, put a compulsion in me, so that I wanted to see all the mommy and daddy marks jangling around inside, fuck like rabbits and make little baby bits that might one day grow up to be big mommy and daddy marks like their parents. And if you're listening to this and thinking such a thing is low or shameful, doubly so considering Reese's lineage, well, I guess you'd be right. But to that I'd answer, try being my kind of poor. I don't know what kind of poor you've tasted in your life, but I can tell you all about mine. It tastes of ash and dirt and muddy shit. It tastes of desperation and sleepless nights. Nights spent wide awake in a dripping, rancid back alley, knowing rightly that to sleep is to be interfered with by about 10 different men all larger than you. You know it because you can hear it happening somewhere close by, and your first thought isn't to go help. It's raw, stupid gratitude to whoever might still give a fuck about your prayers that the back alley ravagers didn't find you instead. And you're grateful to the one getting his, even grateful to his asshole, I suppose, which must see the morning fundamentally different. And you got through another night. Hungry, yes, maybe a little sick, maybe a lot sick, but intact by the fucking gods. Or at least as intact as you ever would be. I say try it that way a while, maybe only for as long as you can, though that might be just a day, or an hour, or a minute. Then think about how long I've been at it, how my hair is graying and my knuckles are gnarled, my back crooked, and how ending a digger seemed to me the finest station I'd ever attain, dirt floor, hateful looks and all. To my mind, I deserve a commendation for the basic truth that I've never slit a man's throat for his purse. Sometimes I think it would have been easier that way, shortened lifespan or not. But I had a taste of a new life that day. I'd seen the way forward to leaving the digger behind, and it was delicious. But I was still in that fucking corner. The lout wouldn't fight. Okay, that's one skill eliminated. The problem, though, is that a con is required in order for a con to work. No fighting, and all we had left was his strength and his speed. I certainly couldn't get the son of a bitch to tell riddles or recite verse. I intended the Kraftkrieg as our model, strength contests to be specific. So, when we arrived at that town, Echternach, our possessions included one donkey, one small purse, a modest store of provisions, I was out of liquor, sadly, our purse, which must remain hidden at all costs, and one half-naked giant. And now I'll ask you to solve the problem here. Having only these things at your disposal, how do you hold contests of strength? I would have settled on arm wrestling, but we didn't even have a table to lean on. Things had sure seemed easier earlier that day, but I was beginning to realize that the planning of fine detail might not have been my long suit, and maybe I'd better start dealing with that. Maybe I'd better deal with it immediately as I was walking through the town. Echternach was a lovely place. It was innocent of any nobility, which in itself is a blessing of the gods, as the territory was overseen by a lesser vassal who'd begun his career as a hedge knight of some sort. He must have done something to make someone happy. Ambrosius, I presume, given it was within his domain. But no one spoke his name in the streets, and I never bothered to learn it. I got the sense his whole existence revolved around managing his own estate, collecting taxes for the lord, and avoiding conflict. He may have gone south, in fact, with the rest of the press-ganged army. The town itself seemed to have sprung up overnight from a goodly crowd of wealthy traders and merchants. Every building I saw seemed new, scarcely a year over 50, and the poor district was about the finest-looking slums I'd ever seen. I began to worry that we were in the wrong place, that the town was composed completely of the rich. But I did not worry long. The rich always surround themselves with the less rich. Who else would do all the work otherwise? So they were out there, the laborers and hard men. I just had to find them. And I had to find the various props and gear I would need to carry the con, all in that same town. And because I didn't want word spreading around, because word always travels fast, I had to go to one end of town to seek out the sheep, and then to the opposite goddamned end of town to buy the shears. And buy the shears I did. I went to the roper's first to purchase a nice, strong coil as thick around as my wrist, then to the smith's for some good bar stock. And finally, I sought out a local carpenter where I haggled far too long over a small butcher's table before settling on an old wooden crate for 2 bits. Then I hired the carpenter's apprentice to carry it back out to the boulder while I saw to collecting our flock. In earshot of the carpenter, I told the boy I'd pay him a bit for his trouble. But then when we were outside of the shop where the carpenter couldn't hear, I gave him 5 and winked. He smiled at me before running off, carrying the crate clumsily and shifting it all around. And I knew I judged right, the apprentice game being what it had always been and all. I went to the other end of town, which was a short enough walk anyway, and started fishing taverns as before. I changed the lay, though. I wasn't looking for fighters now. I was looking for good, loud-mouthed drunkards, the kind of men who were made strong by their labors, strong enough that they had unreasonable expectations of their strength, and all it took was one too many drinks to send them into the land of fantasy. You don't have to insult the honor of such men most times. All you really need to do is point them in the direction of a hill too steep to climb, a horse too wild to break, or a task too great for any 3 men to achieve. You point them at it, and then just state the truth. You tell them they cannot, and let their nature and the drink take over. These are wonderful, blessed men I'm describing here. The line was simple and included as much of the truth as was sensible. We were working our way through the country, town to town, living off the proceeds of the contest. My good friend, who waited just outside the boundary, was the strongest man in all of Erda. He'd not been bested once, not in all his days, but any as were in that alehouse who were yet unbowed from their daily toil could have their chance at him for a mark. There would be several classic contests which eager challenger could choose according to his strengths. It was a single mark to compete, and if a man could beat Risa at any one of the contests, even after several attempts, I would pay out 20. In the evening, I stood out at the boulder beside Risa and Ambrosius amid our cart, the crate, the coil of rope, several lengths of good iron bar stock, and many rocks and boulders of varying size, ranging from that of a man's head to a full-grown goat. I'd set Risa to gathering them all up before strolling into town earlier. We 3 stood together silently and watched the procession of men, women, and children come from the town gates to meet with us. "Hell, I didn't think I'd net that many," I said. "Many," Risa agreed. I glanced at my friend. As always, it was hard for me to know if he understood my words or just repeated them. I said, "What's the sign, Risa?" He blinked at me a few moments, then pulled gently at his earlobe. "Good. And the others?" He scratched his elbow, seemed to think a while, then cleared his throat loudly. "My boy. All right. So when I do that, tell me again what that means."
"Risa fails."
"What does it mean to fail?"
"Don't win."
I patted him on the shoulder and smiled. He smiled back. I prayed desperately by the graying hair of Godin's balls that we understood each other. I looked out at the approaching crowd. It seemed they'd halved the distance between us and the town's border. There was still enough light to see, though it was fading, and straining my eyes, I could tell that the carpenter's apprentice was at the forefront. I wondered if he'd been into some rumor-mongering of his own, and smiled. It was useful to understand. In the next town, I wouldn't have to do my own fishing. All it would take was a few apprentices in good standing. Street urchins were no good. They fetched a slap upside the head if they did anything more than hold their hand out. Hand them all a fistful of bits, being as bits were now so gloriously common, and send them out like an army of scouts. It was beautiful. But those people just kept coming, more and more of them, and I grew nervous. I had to walk a fine line between notoriety and legend. A little notoriety was to our advantage, assuming we lived on the road and kept ahead of the recruiters. That was manageable business. But let Risa become a legend that people believed in rather than scoffed at, well, I figured that recruiters would be searching us out if it came to that. I lost much sleep over these things back then. I think if I'd known then what I know now, I probably would have just taken Risa into the hills somewhere and lived with him quietly, taught him enough language to be interesting, and leave it there. I liked him a lot better back then, the way he was. I was worried at first that the men would be resentful of Risa besting them so easily. Then, too, their women and children had come out to watch, and I feared their resentment as well. A little resentment spreading through a mob is a dangerous thing, and I was very fearful. The crowd watched silently as he chewed through the first 10 men at the arm wrestling table, and when he chewed through 10 more, I felt they weren't even breathing. I didn't signal him to lose at the table, thinking it too unlikely. But after some 28 men with their arms all folded over as though they were children, I suggested they shift events to a good tug of war to even up the odds. Risa against any two of their best. Even then, I didn't signal. I let him drag the men inexorably along the loam, their heels kicking up great divots while they cursed and spat and strained against him. I let him do that a few more times as well, waiting until I heard the wives muttering and noted the men of the crowd looking on blackly as if our sole purpose that morning had been to shame them before their families. This was when I decided. I put my hands up and called, "Okay, people, let's take a moment, please." I didn't have to call loudly. They were very sullen. "I think I've had enough of this son of a bitch winning, eh? What about the rest of you? Would you see the bastard lose even once? Would you see him slow down even?" They were still silent, but looked interested at least. "Let's put another man on the end of that rope, eh? How about it? Surely there's another man out there as can spare a mark? Come now. The very least of you is still three times my better. There must be someone." Someone came forward. Risa hauled all three across the loam, and our purse fattened. "Another! By tear, we'll have the bastard take a step forward or shit our guts out along the grass. Who is out there that can't spare a single mark? Who is out there that wouldn't be better off with 20? Someone came forward. Risa hauled all four across the loam, and our purse fattened. "For the love of Freeg, Godin's love and Seek's needs fury, and the light of Sunna and Zintgun both, and by Ing's sweet loins, who will drag this man forward? Another! Someone send us another!"
"Why not send another 20 then?"
someone shouted. Many of the others nodded their heads. "It must be a challenge," I called. "As easily put all of you on the other end of that rope, though I imagine such a number would slow Erda's flight through the outer chaos. One at a time keeps it interesting, or say two at a time at least. Two. Two, are there two of you?" Two came forward. As they made ready at the rope, I saw the younger of the two wind his arm around it a few times and drag the remainder across his chest before passing it to the man behind him. I approached and whispered, "Unwind your arm, son."
"I'll pull it my own way,"
he nearly growled. His eyes bored into Risa, who stood at the other end blinking childishly at the audience. "Unwind your fucking arm," I hissed. "Unwind the fucking thing before he separates it from your shoulder." He faltered. Some of the fire leaked out of him as he considered. I think he must have seen something in my eyes. He must have realized I knew something. Slowly, he nodded and unbound himself. I nodded back at him and whispered, "Honor, games, and profit are one thing, son. But let's see that you can still work tomorrow morning." I slapped him on the shoulder, stepped away, and shouted, "Okay, make the fucker step forward." Then I let Risa pull them. I let him pull the men right up to the line before tugging at my ear. Risa did the job beautifully, better than I could have hoped. I'd wondered how he would sell it, if he would let the rope slip from his hands, or if he would simply fall over, or some other obvious display. He did none of those. He slowed. I saw the light come through his eyes when he looked at me. We looked at each other, and both knew. I knew he understood, and he knew I knew. In the time before Tyr spoke to him, it was the clearest communication with my giant I'd ever had. It was amazing, and when he performed, I thought I understood what it might be like if, at least once in the long, turning, fucked-up world, a man who actually deserved a son had one. He slowed his backward pace, feet moving less and less, until the toe of the lead man's boot brushed the stick we'd laid down to mark the center line. Then he held his position and flexed his arms in such a way that the muscles bunched and twisted. His face went from resolute to strained, and slowly his back began to round over. In the crowd, I saw faces shift from passive to alert. I saw eyes widen and mouths open, and the men at the rope began to strain loudly. They growled out curses and encouragement to each other, and some of their women stepped forward and chanted into their ears, admonishing them to show up well for their sons, promising them a night to curl their toes, promising them anything should they just pull that giant across the line. Then Risa took a step forward, and the crowd sighed. They sighed like wind passing through the trees, like the clouds spinning always overhead, and when he took a second step forward, a large woman who looked as old as me and twice as rough shouted, "Go on then, Angus! Pull him across now and I'll pull you across tonight! I'll pull you across with my own bloody mouth, you beauty! Only take him over the line!" Risa took another step forward, and that whole fucking crowd went up like a riot. I cheered right along with them, and I felt arms slip around shoulders and shake me. Men laughed with me, laughed into my ears and jostled me about, and I laughed with them. I couldn't help it. I told myself I should not, that these were not my people, that they'd tie me to a rail and send me down the river if they knew who I was, what I was. But they laughed and put their arms around me and shouted. When Risa allowed himself to be pulled across that line, they all screamed even louder. And I knew we had a running lay. The games went long into the evening. I don't recall the take, as I was yet unlettered and could not keep accurate records. I want to say I paid out 80 marks, each round of 20 having to be divided up between the men that bested the giant, as was fair, and yet we still came out well ahead. Everyone wanted to test the giant that night, even the women, who I think traded their mark just for an excuse to feel his hand or to touch his arm. I still hadn't found a shirt that would fit him, and the evening's exertion put a glimmer on his skin so that it glowed in the torchlight. Some of those women were very local in their appreciation, and the men at their sides laughed along with the rest of us. One of them, I don't recall his name, shouted that he half wanted to fuck the giant alongside his wife, and by that time we'd all given over any pretense at propriety in front of the children. The children wanted to test themselves as well, so I charged each of them a bit to toe the line on the great Teodiscan wonder, which is what we began to call him that evening. Sometimes these children failed to weasel a bit from their fathers, and I stayed out of it. But sometimes I saw there were children who had no fathers to pester. These I took aside, spoke to them a while, and then stood them all a bit from my purse. They made to rush forward into the fray, but I held them back. "Wait a while," I said, "and let these others go first. Let's wait until the giant's tired again." They nodded at me slyly and waited. As we stood there, I saw other children who seemed more quiet than usual, more withdrawn than they should be, and I waved them over as well. I brought them in on it and made them ready. When it was time, I sent them all in for the kill. To their great surprise, they pulled Risa all the way down to the grass, felling him like a great oak, and they collapsed upon him, laughing. Risa was laughing, his voice thundering in huge, booming cracks, and I could see tears in his eyes. The quiet children came back to me when it was done and gave me the distrustful eye, the look that said they were now ready to be cheated. I went into my purse and counted out 2 full marks worth of bits, 200 bits, which once would have seemed a small fortune, but now seemed small change, and dragged the largest over by the ear. He winced as I pulled him in close and snarled, "You divide these up even, you hear?"
"Yeah, mister, let go of my fucking ear."
I twisted it until it fair popped from his head and said, "Shut your goddamn mouth, just listen. I'm watching you, you little fuck. You divided up right among all these boys. Divided up, or I swear to all of the high nine and the lesser breed, besides I'll hunt you down and have the giant squeeze your legs until they fucking splinter. Hear me?"
"Yeah, goddamn, you leave off. You're twisting it off my head."
I buried my thumbnail into the flesh until I could see the water stand out in his eyes. "Fucking tell me what to do, you little boy whore. They fuck better than you and Gosler, remember that. Now get over and pay it out." I turned him loose, and he stumbled back a few steps. I don't think he was more than 10. He looked up at me with pure poison, face flushed red as a beet, and I saw his hand creep toward the shiv I knew he kept bound up at his waist. He would have killed me right then, I think, or tried to, if he thought he could get at me. I nodded at him and smiled. He was a good lad, and I liked him. He would grow up hard, which meant he had half a chance at growing up honest, and I liked that he would one day be a man who could not be fucked with. He went back to the other lads and began to dole it out. He kept his murderous, hateful eyes on me as much as he could, but he also stole glances at Risa from time to time. And that was good. It was late when we finally broke it up, but by then the people wouldn't let us alone. The women kept running their hands over the hard muscles of Risa's belly, causing him to giggle wildly, and they giggling along with him. And pretty soon we found ourselves swept up in the mob, being pulled back to town by way of the nearest alehouse. I fought to resist at first, to get back to Ambrosius and our goods. But suddenly Ambrosius's lead was pressed into my hand. The donkey looked up at me like I'd visited a calamitous disaster upon his head. But the man who brought him to me pressed him gently to my side. And beyond, I saw two more of them pulling my cart along. They kept close by, as though intentionally holding my belongings within sight. One of the larger men, one in fact who had earned a payout at the stone toss, came up alongside me and asked, "Have your purse, Yander?" "I do, yes." "That's well. Keep it close. All night keep it close, and I'll keep close as well to watch." I wanted to be suspicious of him, but he was so matter-of-fact, as if he said the most reasonable thing in history, that I could not. I thought it over quickly, trying to ken the unfathomable. Was this how it was? Was this how normal people treated each other? "What warrants this favor? What will you take as payment?" I asked. "I've already been paid," he smiled. "Tonight you put more in my family's hands than I've earned in the last month. Tonight I'm your man." This was when I first understood that not all cons need be harmful. I understood Risa and I were doing great things. We were men of greatness, the both of us, and we were doing very wonderful things. If only we could keep the truth from getting in our way.